In one incident, I remember we were on the road along the coast and we were actually going towards the coast and there were cars coming the other way, beeping their horns. And we asked our driver, there must be something happening here. Everybody's going in the other direction. And in fact, he said, tsunami alert. And I remember I was with the president of TSF at the time, my former boss, and we had taken off our shoes because it was quite warm. And I remember he just said, I think it's time to put on our shoes because we might need to run.
You're listening to Speechmark, a podcast by Vodafone that delves into the people and technologies behind our connected future. I'm your host, Ellie Williams. Connectivity leaves a mark on everything it touches. This is a podcast about connectivity and the people working on technology that will make society's future ready. Connectivity has become such an ingrained part of our daily lives that we often take it for granted, even, or perhaps especially, when we need it most. It's easy to forget that the networks which we rely on for everything, from watching cat videos to contacting friends around the world, are dependent on local physical infrastructure. In the case of a natural disaster, the communications networks can often be damaged or destroyed, meaning that the people affected are unable to contact loved ones or get updates from emergency services and aid organisations. This is where Telecom Sans Frontières and Vodafone Foundation's Instant Network Disaster Response Team come in. Volunteers who work for Vodafone around the globe travel to the scene after a natural disaster and set up a temporary mobile network to bring connectivity to the people who need it most. Here are some of the stories of these volunteers.
My name is Oisin Walton. I'm Instant Network Program Manager at Vodafone Foundation. Before joining Vodafone Foundation, I used to work for an NGO called Telecom Sans Frontières, TSF, which has been a partner of Vodafone Foundation for the last 15 years. So Vodafone Foundation started funding TSF, and we're actually the main donor of TSF today. And about 7-8 years ago, well, actually a bit more, it was 9 years ago, Vodafone Foundation, the director of Vodafone Foundation, Andrew Dunnett, went to TSF and said, you're the number one telecoms NGO in the world. We're the number one telecoms company. We've been giving you cash. How can we help you more? And TSF said, if we had a network in a box that we could deploy in disasters, we heavily rely on satellite communications, but we know the importance of mobile networks in disasters. If we could get a pop-up mobile network in disasters, that would help us save lives. So Vodafone Technology, Huawei, and TSF worked together in Madrid to come up with a solution called Instant Network, which is a mobile network in three boxes, weighing in total roughly 100 kilos and can be set up in a couple of hours on the ground. And the idea, it started with a 2G network. Now we have a 3G version and 4G. And we have a series of innovations that we developed. But I left TSF in 2012, and Andrew called me and said, we've got this great network, instant network that we developed together with TSF. Would you like to join us and set up a program at Vodafone Foundation? And I joined, and we soon realized that we needed, because of the sensitivity of deploying mobile networks, particularly in emergencies, we couldn't just hand Instant Network to NGOs and donate the kit and for them to deploy it. So we needed Vodafone to be involved in the process of deploying the network. And that's where the idea of creating a volunteer program came. And we started our first training of 25 volunteers in June 2012. I joined in September 2011, and we trained our first volunteers in Madrid, which were at the time mainly network engineers who would deploy networks for Vodafone across 20 countries. And it started from there and grew from there. And today we have 70 volunteers in 19 countries.
My name is Lisa Mackey, and I am an Instant Network volunteer based in New Zealand. I've been involved in the Instant Network since 2014. And I have deployed three times, all as a result of natural disasters. When you're called up to deploy, I think the first thing that hits you is a wave of self-doubt. You wonder if you've got what it takes to be able to race into a situation where everyone else is leaving. It's been a natural disaster, you know, and you think, what can I bring to this situation that's going to improve it? So you do ponder for a little bit to wonder, what can you do that's going to help people? And do you have the right skill set? And there's also a fear of the unknown. What am I going to find when I land on the ground? Often in these situations, people have died. Their homes have been destroyed. Access to things like water and food is very limited. By definition, the reason we're deploying is because there's no communications. So you really don't have a lot of information about what's happening on the ground.
My name is Phil Greedy. I work in Vodafone UK. My role as a day job is an investigation manager for Vodafone UK. None of us want to have to deploy, but it all comes down to the way that the world works and natural disasters and that kind of thing. And, you know, through hurricane season, there's often calls out for people to volunteer.
My name is Davide Camponizzi, and I work in Disaster Recovery Department of Vodafone Italy.
Before working in Vodafone, I was an IT manager of a multinational company based in Cleveland, USA. And I had the responsibility to expand, improve the Italian plants. I have been working for 20 years in Vodafone Italy, covering different roles within the technology department. And now, just over a year, I am a part of the disaster recovery department, where I'm trying to evolve the technology and the technical solution with the experience that we had during emergency mission with the Global Foundation. For example, I have some apps on my phones that alert me about earthquake, landslide, or critical situation around the globe. So sometimes I can be ready before that OISIN contact us just to asking for a mission.
Once you get past that initial self-doubt, the adrenaline kicks in. Then you're flat strapped trying to work out everything that you need to take with you in country so that you are completely independent, that you're not relying on the locals to feed you, to provide you with shelter, and to also sort out what the technical solution is going to be. Because once you are in country, it's not like you can whip around to the local hardware store or the electronic shop and buy different parts. So it's pretty intense in the lead up, and you get very limited sleep. You are racing around trying to get everything organized. And that's probably for the first 48 hours. And one of the key things there is also remembering your own personal safety. So it's making sure that you have everything you need, you know, as an individual, as well as what the technical solution needs and what people on the ground will need. So you're making sure that you've got all your medications, you've got all your sunscreen and all of that good stuff.
My name's Chris Trundley. I joined Vodafone 4 years ago. It was actually a lot more calm and collective than I expected it was going to be. Everyone was dealing with the situation in a really calm and professional manner. There was a lot of devastation. The trees, you can see there was a lot of damage. There was a lot of flooding, roofs off houses, that kind of thing. But the people themselves, they were really resourceful. They cleared pretty much all the roads, all the trees you'd seen. They'd been out with chainsaws and cleared all the roads. So a lot of it was open for us to be able to get to the locations we needed to.
When you get in country, it's another adrenaline rush, because that's when you start to see the actual impact of the natural disaster. And you see photos of it, you might see news stories on the TV, but it does not prepare you for the sights, the smells, the sounds that don't come out in those stories that are edited out. I think an overwhelming memory of landing in Vanuatu was the smell of smoke, because it was the only way that people could get rid of all the debris from the cyclone, because all their houses had been destroyed and there were trees everywhere and they were just burning everything to get rid of it.
It was a disaster zone. There were massive impacts to all their infrastructure. The island's airports were out of action. There's two airports in Dominica, both were out of action. There was no boat sailing to the islands. They had no power. The hospitals were severely damaged. They really needed help, but it was very much a case of searching for survivors, trying to assess the damage when we arrived, first of all, in Barbados. And we were sat around in some of the meetings with the Caribbean Disaster Emergencies Committees, surrounded by governors and UN, Red Cross, all trying to work out how they were going to get their own people on the ground to actually start with sorting out sanitation, getting fresh water to the island. The British military were out there helping with the British Virgin Islands. Our colleagues in British Telecom were over in the British Virgin Islands helping out, sorting out satellite communications up there. The focus was Dominica, really, because it had been so badly affected.
So my first mission was 15 years ago. It makes me sound very old, but I'm only 39. It was the Asian tsunami in 2004, Boxing Day tsunami. I was at home. I was working for TSF. I'd been with TSF for 6 months. And woke up on Boxing Day with the tsunami, saw the news, immediately went to the office at TSF and deployed. I mean, you always remember your first mission. It's an emotional moment. I was deployed to Sri Lanka. There were, I think, 7 or 8 countries affected in total by the Asian tsunami. 200,000 people killed, millions affected. And I was deployed to Sri Lanka. And so what we were doing was offering free calls with satellite phones. So going along the coast in shelters where people who had lost everything were sheltered and providing free calls so that they could give news to their family.
When you finally get the technical solution working, so we set up the free calling and the free Wi-Fi, you get to see that first successful phone call. It is an overwhelming sensation. I'm brought to tears each time because it's the reward for all of that adrenaline and that stress and those sleepless nights and that worry. And you see the relief on the faces of the people making the phone calls. And you imagine what they've been through and you try and put yourself in that situation. And who would be my first phone call? And I think about that probably being my dad and what it would be like to hear his voice after you've been through hell and back. It's pretty special.
People often ask us, when do you deploy and what triggers a deployment? So generally, there are two situations where we deploy. One is we receive a request from a partner. So this can be TSF, UNHCR, Red Cross, etc. And the other one is where there is a sudden onset disaster, where we will identify needs from the information that we see, and by experience, we'll see that there is a need for communications, media reports saying communication lines are down. And then we will mobilize a team, send out an alert to our volunteers, asking them their availability and whether they can deploy or not. And they'll say yes or no, and we'll select the team. And generally within 24 to 48 hours, we're on the ground. Once we get on the ground, to connect the incident network, we need power. We carry generators, so we need fuel, and we need a backhaul. So for non-technical language, is basically we need to connect that site, that remote site that is on the ground, to the core network via the internet. And to do that, we would connect our base station on the ground over the internet into the core network of Vodafone or a partner operator. In the Philippines, for example, we've deployed 3 times and we work very closely with Smart Communications, who have a license in the Philippines, who are a partner market as well of Vodafone, and who also share the ambition and the vision of Vodafone Foundation that when there is an emergency, everyone should be able to make that call to say, I am alive, whether they have money, whether they don't. So we would connect over satellite into the core network. We started with a 2G version 7 years ago, and now we have a 3G to 4G capacity. But it all really depends on the satellite backhaul. There are challenges in emergencies in the sense that most of the sites in cities would be connected via microwave or fiber, giving a lot more bandwidth and offering more speed on the internet and more capacity to users. In the case of satellite, when you're sharing, let's say, a 10 megabyte connection with thousands of people on the ground, that's when it becomes challenging. So we have the choice between providing fewer services to more people or providing bigger capacity to a fewer number of people. So we always adapt to the needs on the ground, and we work very closely with humanitarian actors to say, okay, this is what the equipment can do. Would you prefer to provide just SMS and potentially voice in a bigger range to more people? Or would you rather have higher capacity and particularly internet access for aid workers only in a base camp? And we can adapt, and we've had different scenarios where we've opened the network, closed it, or limited to a certain number of users, et cetera, et cetera.
There was a woman there called Lisbeth, and she worked for the University of the South Pacific, and she used the calling and also the internet to be in touch with her managers in Port Vila and Fiji. And what she needed to do was sort out alternative arrangements for exams that were meant to be taking place for 70 of the university's undergrad and postgrad students that were on the island. And when she was doing that, it was just this stark reminder that, you know, there's no convenient time for a cyclone. Although I'm sure some of the students who hadn't studied were probably happy, but, you know, she had to try and sort out, what am I going to do about these exams? How are they going to graduate? And then the other thing that we did in Vanuatu is we set up an internet connection in a second location next to the bank, the post office, the airline, and the phone company that we were partnering with, TVL. And what that Wi-Fi internet connection allowed the bank to do was to start communicating with the main office, and they were able to order enough cash to restock the ATM machine in time for the government payday. And why that was important is it meant that locals could come and get cash out so they could start paying for their water and food and fuel and everything that they needed to start rebuilding. Otherwise, the bank wouldn't have had any money and the recovery would have been delayed. So the way we help isn't just confined to one person calling another person to say, I'm alive. Once you provide connectivity, you restart life on so many different fronts. It reminds you of the power of a single phone call that we take for granted every other day of the week. We ignore phone calls, we send emails and instant messages and things like that without thinking often of the impact that those can have. And then suddenly we care a hell of a lot about them once we can't do it. So that's, I think, the power of the Instant Network Program, is just reminding people of the power of one phone call, or one Facebook post, or one email, or one text.
So the different age groups there. So we had a lot of children there, then you had teenagers, and then the elderly came out. And each group, really, they interacted differently, and it's quite good to see. The children, for example, they all got brought out their tablets and their laptops, and they were connecting to the internet. And I was wandering around chatting with them, and I thought they were all going to be playing Fortnite or something, but they weren't. They were on their local school website, and they were discussing amongst the other colleagues that their class friends for a science project that they needed to get done. So, yeah, they had this natural disaster, but they were still thinking about their schoolwork, which is, you know, really good to see. And the elderly, one thing that sticks in my mind from that was a lady, her sister was an overseas Filipino worker, and she was living in Hong Kong. And after the typhoon had struck the Philippines, it then hit Hong Kong, and neither of them had been in touch with each other to find out if they were safe. So once we had set up the communications link, she made her first phone call to her sister, and the emotion on her face made the whole trip. If we just made that one connection, that would have been worthwhile. It was really good to see. The local pastor. So I introduced him to WhatsApp. So we set up internet connectivity for them. And he had a smartphone, but had never used anything other than a text. So we set up WhatsApp for him, and then he was instantly amazed by the fact that he could talk, make a phone call via WhatsApp. So he was phoning his family, letting them know that he was safe, and they obviously let him know that they were all safe.
You can think that you can charge your phone everywhere. There is not a problem here in Europe. In Asia, in America, in a normal situation, in a normal scenario. If you have to think about a refugees that they risk their life on a boat with 100 and 100 peoples, and just to make a call, like I saw in Greece and Macedonia, make a call to their family that they are still alive, that they are... touch the the European continent, and they are still alive, and they can recharge the phone with our instant charge system, it really changed the life of refugees. One challenge I experienced in the mission was during the earthquake in the center of Italy, in Amatrice, in 2016, where about 240 people died, and I was there after a few hours from the disaster, organizing a support to the rescue personnel directly on site with our instant charge kits. I personally will always remember the smell of the exploded concrete and the twisted iron of the destroyed houses in a devastated scenario where 8 helicopters have continued to fly for many days to the hospital to try to save as many people as possible. In this mission, the thanks of many rescue people, police, civil protection, make me realize that sometimes being able to recharge a phone really can save many lives.
It was a difficult decision. We were all really disappointed because we knew we could add value out there, but it was just, it's our own safety, I suppose, at the end of the day, that people need to make that decision. So what we ended up doing, we had everything boxed ready to go. We donated all our rations that we bought and our water supplies, sent that across. We sent the Wi-Fi kit and some of the telecoms kit straight across the island on the plane that we were supposed to be on. And colleagues in Telecom Sans Frontières were already on the island, and they made use of that kit when it arrived. They then deployed it themselves as our assistants. So we weren't on the ground, but our equipment was used in the days afterwards.
It took quite a few weeks to get back into the cadence of my normal life. My first day back in the office was probably one of the least productive days I've ever had in my job, because you just think, what's the point? I've just come from helping people who've lost everything to worrying that I've got a typo in a PowerPoint. It just seemed trivial.
After the first courses and the first mission, like I said, the standard network program for me is, how can I say, far behind the program, but it's become a way of life. I'm lucky to have a wife who supports me a lot every time I go in the mission. And 11 years old, the daughter who accidentally asked me to summarize in one single picture, so what's your daddy do when he's on the mission? It was not really easy to summarize all in one single picture, but my daughter's answer was that she really wants to do the same work of daddy in the future. There is no better way to understand how important is our work, seeing from the eyes of children, especially for poor and remote peoples in Africa. So briefly, if I have to summarize the soul and the spirit of the Eastern Network program in three objectives, I would describe it as a perfect mix between solidarity, technology, and humanity.
The other thing that happens when you come home is it's really hard to describe what it was like to deploy. You know, you can show photos, you can take videos, you can try and tell people about it, but the emotional connection that you have with the local residents, not just for that phone call or that Facebook post, but like I said, you know, we were living in their house and sharing meals in a very unusual situation. In any other situation, I wouldn't ever be on that island. I wouldn't ever have met those people. And it's under very trying situations. So you strike up these incredibly intense friendships in a very short amount of time. And trying to explain that to people when you come back to the office or back to your family, words fail. So you have to have some downtime when you get back from deployment. It's not all beer and Skittles, as they say. You have to process what you've been through.
At the back of the mosque, they were burying people and dead bodies, and we were not too far from there offering free calls. The mosque was where a lot of people came to receive aid. There was distribution, food distributions, water distributions, etc., and we were offering free calls. And I remember the end of the day coming to the president of TSF and saying, thank you for creating an NGO like TSF and showing the power and the need for communications in emergencies. And that was 15 years ago. Obviously, the landscape in networks and technology has changed a lot. And mobile networks today, you know, when we go back 15 years ago, there were very few mobiles. Today, in many countries, the majority of families have smartphones. You rely on the internet to receive and send news, talk to your family, wherever they are in the world, on Skype, WhatsApp, etc. You can buy goods. You can transfer money. So it's a whole new era in terms of communications and technology and disaster response.
SpeechMark is an experiment from Vodafone, and we hope you enjoyed this as much as we enjoyed making it. So please rate and review so we can make it even better in the future. To find more stories, conversations, and insights about the connected digital world, go to gigalife.vodafone.com. Special thanks go to Oisin Walton, David Campanizzi, Lisa Mackey, Phil Greedy, and Chris Trundley. This series was brought to you by Chris Jennings, Josie Semple, Armin Bodossian, Lucas Sesford, Alex Yobet, and Max Thompson, and produced by Paddle Productions. I'm Ellie Williams. Thank you for listening.
Because it was a natural disaster, they pretty much seconded whatever transport they could get. So I think it was their equivalent of the head of BT out there, which I can't remember what the name of their company was now, but they owned that helicopter, and inside it was all gold-plated. And we got into this helicopter with a big satellite dish and all our equipment, and we're trying not to scratch anything because there's gold-plated seat belts. We then flew up a country and landed in where we needed to be.